Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. Katie, did you get that Scott's comments right before you started? It happens every week.
I'm sure it's recorded in here, but it was before the music started.
The music hadn't started.
No, but she hits record well before the music starts.
Well, that's her
fault.
And
you're always talking, or you always are silent, and then like seconds before the music starts, Scott says something. This week it was, I'm not ready, but go ahead.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you got,
There it is. Because I'm not ready, but
well,
go ahead.
Scott's in the hot seat.
It's too late now.
You're in the hot seat.
The big chair.
Today. The big chair, sorry. Not the hot seat.
Get it right, man.
It's your turn.
Just because it's been 10 days since we've done this doesn't mean that everybody should have forgotten how to do this.
I know. And we are on our brand new day of recording. We're in the same studio. Same people.
Yep.
Nothing's going to change. Still going to drop the episodes
on
Wednesday.
We're all still wearing the same clothes we were wearing the last time we were here.
Yeah.
And that's been 10 days ago.
Yeah.
It's so weird that we're all wearing the same outfits.
I've had a laundry cycle since then, so we're fine.
Yeah, we'll talk about that hat after we get off the air. Katie had a good time last night. She's wearing her hat today.
Yes.
It is Labor Day weekend.
Happy Labor Day, everybody. I hope that when you are listening to this, you had a safe and fun.
So we probably should have said that last week.
Labor Day.
Yeah.
So that's over with.
Yeah.
And now it's fall.
Don't say it's not fall. We had this conversation via text message a minute ago. It's not fall yet.
It is fall because I sent you a text that said September equals fall.
I saw it.
It's basic algebra.
Yeah. Once Labor Day.
That's not algebra.
It's no longer summer. Just like when Memorial Day gets here, it is summer.
So I have to put away my white shoes. Is that what you're telling me?
Nothing. No white pants after Labor Day. I don't care about
shoes. I have white pants.
I think shoes are supposed to be in there too. So
yeah.
Mm.
All right. Well.
Okay. So no white shoes.
But you know the new thing now is winter white. So like,
is
who
it?
The hell
it's
knows
like
anymore?
Right. And it's like a slightly different version of the summer white.
I don't know what you guys are drinking, but I like it.
This is a pumpkin spice latte.
Any Kahlua in there?
Because it's fall. No, there's no Kahlua.
And.
Well, that's a missed opportunity.
That's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it is
that's,
for me.
That's bad.
Just, if I come to your house.
Just to spite you, Scott, I put peppermint mocha in my coffee.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
So I'm just
going
to bring it all the way to Christmas.
She's just like...
All right. I'm out of here. You guys will have to finish this one without me. I refuse to participate.
My name is Kelly Turner, and I am not a doctor.
My name is Scott Wright. I am a mediocre journalist.
I'm Katie Givens. I'm not a lawyer.
Not yet, at least.
Not yet. She's
still
working on it, but
we're still there.
I've got a plan for that.
I'm not going to harp on this every week.
Oh, sure you are.
You will be tired of hearing about it, how stressed I am about this intro. No. So last week, I gave a shout out to a couple of colleagues, and I want to give a shout out to one of those colleagues again, Cheryl. Told me.
Sounds like a double dip, but go ahead.
It is a double dip. And I'm so grateful because she told me about a show that is on Hulu and it is Haunted History.
Oh.
Episode 1 is about the Manson murders. And I have not watched the entire episode, but I've watched a little bit of it. And so there is a movie producer or a director, I can't remember which one he was, but he lives in a house that is so many hundreds of feet from where the house was on
so
CLO
Drive. So
he's
not at 10050 CLO Drive, but he's in the neighborhood.
He might even have that address.
Okay.
I don't know. But he's right there.
Okay.
You know, you made the statement when we did the Manson murders that the house is gone now.
Yeah, they tore that house down in 94 and they built a mansion there that somebody didn't like. They tore it down and built another one. So there's the third house on that site.
So he lives in this area.
Okay.
I don't know exactly what his address is and it might eventually tell it, but like I said, I'm
Well, they changed that
through.
Address so that people can't find it anymore because, you know, the gawkers.
Right. Now, he made it seem as if everybody's heard of the Manson murders pretty much.
Yeah.
But I don't think he knew a whole lot about the individuals who were murdered near there on Cielo Drive.
Yeah.
But he claims that the first apparition that he saw there was a man who he saw in the middle of the night at the foot of his bed, much like Shane's ghost story that Shane told
back
in season 1.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. He's standing there. And the man himself is the source of light, but he's also gray and shaded. But he says, I remember that face. I remember exactly what he looked like. And they show him a picture of Jay Sebring, our Alabama tie.
Yes.
And he says, that's him.
Really?
Wow.
He's also had some other things happen there, and I'm sure they're going to go into all of that. But if you want to check that out, it's on Hulu.
I'm checking it out when I get home this afternoon.
Haunted History, Episode 1.
Because it's raining in Cherokee County today. There's no fun on the lake. It's a morbid, overcast Labor Day weekend.
It kind of is. But that doesn't mean we can't have some fun. So
let's do
that's a good way to do that. But thank you, Cheryl, for that.
Cheryl.
Her name is Cheryl Adams.
Way to go, Cheryl. Hey, leave us a 5-star review while you're at it, since we brought you up on the air.
She is a big supporter of our podcast, even dropped our name to James Spann.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, if we can get James Spann on board, then all of our work here is done.
Wouldn't that be fun? We can just coast after that. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
So, anyways, I'm going to check out the rest of that episode today.
Okay.
But the first part of it was really interesting and spooky, you know. And that's not the first ghost story that we've had tied to one of our true crimes here. If you go back to season one and listen to the Reverend, there is a ghost story tied to that.
Yeah, and apparently there's a particular color of paint you can use on your porch to keep them away.
That is called haint paint, and it is a haint blue.
You're welcome for the segue, but I forgot what it was called. But yeah, that.
That.
I'm going to go get a gallon of that and just have it in the house just in case this happens to me.
A lot of people will paint rooms that color, or if you're walking onto someone's front porch, the kind of the ceiling of the porch will
be painted. That's what I remember, the ceiling.
Paint. Yeah.
To ward away the evil spirits.
Mm-hmm. There's a specific type of blue.
There's a certain kind of spirits that I like and a certain kind of spirits that I don't like. As long as it's liquid, I'm good with it.
Exactly.
The other kind, not so much.
I know. So everybody go check that out and let us know what you think about it. I have no idea what the other episodes are about because I didn't get that.
But each one's different.
Each one is different.
Got it.
But it's tied to some sort of historical event.
I don't buy into that hocus pocus. I think it's people having dreams that seem so real.
I'm going to let you and Shane duke that out.
Yeah, I was about to say, you say that because it's not happened to you.
That's true. It has not happened to me.
Shane is very convinced.
I know he is. Shane is not an idiot. He's a lot of things, but he's not an idiot.
He is not.
And he's not a goof.
No.
Or a kook.
And he doesn't like scary things.
Oh, my God.
Oh, and there he is. Shane's in the building.
I have almost...
Hey, don't forget to flush, will you?
That was so scary.
All right, cut it. We got to start over.
Okay, so let me help everybody out. Shane just popped into the studio.
Shane just stuck his head out of the bathroom door. I mean, I don't know what's going on in there, and I don't want to know.
Scared the crap out of all of us.
Thank you.
Now he's flushing.
Please tell
toilet.
Me that we picked up the toilet flushing.
Probably not.
That's the way Shane always plays himself out.
Holy cow. That was terrifying.
All right. Let's get him a mic. I mean, if he's going to be here, we may as well get him involved. No, you're good.
We were talking about your ghost story, Shane.
Yeah, we'll get back to that.
It's very scary.
No, we did not know that you were here.
We did not know that you were here. You're lurking about.
All right. Cut it. Cut all of this.
Yeah. I don't know what you're going to do with that. You can use it or cut it.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I don't. Yeah. Me either.
Anyways, what the hell were we talking about? Oh, we were talking about the Reverend.
Yes.
What did I say?
And the haint paint and the ghost stories and I don't believe it. And, okay. and then Shane appeared from behind the door.
Spooky thing. So I have always wanted like a ghost experience. But I have yet to...
Yeah, careful what you wish for.
I know. Yeah.
That is some scary turf. I did see a very funny meme, and I do not remember if I said this last season. And if I did, I apologize.
That's okay. I repeat myself every week.
But this meme was hilarious. Their rug in their living room, wherever this house was, looked like a Ouija board.
Okay.
Okay.
And they had the Roomba going over, and it said, it's all fun and games until the Roomba summons a spirit.
No, you have not mentioned that, but that's hilarious.
Oh, that's a
just
great...
Just by accident.
Yeah. That's a great meme.
Yeah.
So, well, anyways, this week, as I said earlier, Scott is
what did you say
in the
earlier?
Big chair.
I don't think anybody remembers.
Well, you're in the big chair this week.
Yeah, they're all the same.
We gave Scott.
Katie's in the big chair.
Katie is always in the big chair. Yeah. We gave Scott a very difficult case to handle this week and next week. However, yeah. I have no doubt that he's done a fantastic job. He was going over with me his outline before we started recording today.
Well, let me see if I can make you panic in the next 20 minutes.
No, no, it sounds like a great deal. I am familiar with this case. Katie is too. Normally,
okay, good.
Normally we
ask questions.
Okay. Normally we have at least one of us who is not familiar with the case.
We call it the dummy.
Yeah. We don't have a dummy this week.
I excel at being the dummy. In case listeners out there haven't not pieced that together yet. When it's my turn to be the dummy, I nail that shit.
Scott.
But not today.
Yeah. Well, today.
Today I had to do my homework.
Today you're the expert.
Yes.
And we're going to listen.
I saw you do air quotes. You said expert.
Okay. Well, take it away.
All right. May the 31st, 1985 was a Friday. It was the day, and Kelly and I just figured this out in the parking lot on the way into the studio. It was the day that the movie Fletch with Chevy Chase, one of my favorite films of all times.
Very good movie.
Premiered at the theater, like movies do on Fridays. But on this particular Friday, 17-year-old Sharon Faye Smith, her friends and family called her Sherry, was driving home from a pool party she had been at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Before we get to what happened at her mailbox, let me tell you a little bit about Sherry. She's 17 years old. She is 2 days from graduating from high school. This is on a Friday. She's going to graduate on Sunday. On Monday, she's going to leave to go to the Bahamas on a cruise with all of her senior classmates.
Oh, fun.
Oh.
Yeah. She is going to sing the national anthem at graduation.
Oh, wow.
That morning, the morning of Friday the 31st, she went with her other classmates to the Coliseum on the campus of the University of South Carolina, where the graduation was going to be held, and rehearsed.
As you do.
As you do. She came home. I'm sorry. She came from there. She called home and asked her mother to meet her at the bank in town, because Katie is not going to know what we're talking about. Maybe Kelly will. She had to get some traveler's checks.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I do not know.
I know about those.
So that she could go on her trip. Because back then in the day, traveler's checks were the way before debit cards and the internet was prevalent. And in 85, it was not.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to travel somewhere, the best thing to do was you go in and buy $200 worth of traveler's checks in $20 increments. And there's two blanks on the bottom. You sign on the left side. And then when you cash that traveler's check at a hotel or a bank or a restaurant, you sign the other side. And as long as those two signatures match, you've got money.
It was just a safer way than just having cash.
Exactly. It was a safer way than having cash. So she goes to the bank. She meets her mother at 11 o'clock that morning, around between 11 and 12, to pick up those traveler's checks because she's going on the trip with her friends after graduation. She leaves her car in the parking lot. She gets into the car with her boyfriend and her friend Brenda, and they go to their friend Donna's house to a pool party. And I'm not clear if it was a pool at a lake. It seems like the house is at Lake Murray, okay. But maybe there was a pool at the house at Lake Murray, or maybe it was just a lake party. We do that around here. You just go swim in the lake. Just remember not to swallow anything or get it in your ears.
Yikes.
Anyway, so they left the bank, and Mom brought Sherry a bag with a bathing suit and some jelly shoes. Do you guys know what jelly shoes are? I had to look that up.
I do know that reference.
Okay. She had a pair of black jelly shoes and a beach towel and a bathing suit that her mother brought her.
Okay.
She also had her medicine, because Sherry had diabetes insipidus, which is commonly known as water diabetes, which means that she has to take her medication or she quickly becomes dehydrated. She has to drink a lot of water and take her medicine.
Mm-hmm.
It regulates her system. There's something that her body does not produce that you and I all have that makes us process water and urinate appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
She had to take medicine for that. This will be important in a minute. So she goes to the pool party with her friends, leaves her car there. At 2:30, she calls her mom and says, "Hey, I'm on my way home. They're dropping me off. I'm picking up my car." She's got a little blue Chevy Chevette.
Okay.
It's an ugly car.
It is an ugly car.
I remember.
It was the 80s.
Them driving around. It was the 80s. They were all ugly and just square. And this was one of those.
Mm-hmm. I know the 70s, the cars were so cool. And then like the 80s, it's like, what happened?
Yeah. Well, you know, 55 mile an hour speed limit and gas rationing. And that's, yeah, that was the overflow from, thank you, OPEC from 73.
But I digress. Go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, so she calls mom like she did often. She stayed in touch with her mom. The diabetes had a little bit to do with that. Mm-hmm. They just always wanted to know where she was.
Yes.
So she says, hey, I'm grabbing the car. I'm headed home. And one thing that Sherry did every day when she got home, she checked the mail at the mailbox. The Smiths, Bob and Hilda Smith, live on a 20-acre lot in Red Bank, South Carolina, which is about 8 miles from Lexington, South Carolina. And the city of Lexington is the county seat of Lexington County, South Carolina.
All right.
And that's where they live. She lives on Platte Springs Road with her mom and her younger brother. Her older sister, Dawn, lives in an apartment in Charlotte.
Okay.
I'll get to that in a minute. But so she's there with her younger brother and her parents. And every day, Sherry being a senior, she's the responsible one. She stops at the end of their 750-foot-long driveway.
That's a long driveway.
Yes. And checks the mail.
Well, she's probably got some graduation cards coming.
Right. I mean, but she did it every day. That was just what she did. Yeah. But sure, I mean, especially at this time, she's excited. It's that time. I mean, we've all graduated from high school. So you know what? There's some money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe Aunt June sent me $20.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or whatever. Anyway, like she does every day, she stops at the mailbox. And mom, Hilda, looks out the window and sees the car.
Mm-hmm.
And announces in the house to her husband, Bob, hey, Sherry's home. She's checking the mail. She'll be in a minute.
Okay. And that happened today. May 31st.
At 3:25 on May the 31st, 1985.
Okay. Then what happened?
10 minutes later, Dad realizes Sherry has not come in the house.
Okay.
He looks out the window of his home office. He does some of his work from home. He's a pastor, but he's also an engineer. Okay. And he sells electronic boards like you would see on the side of the highway that say, road is closed, detour here. He sells those kinds of pieces of equipment.
Okay.
So he works from home a lot. So he has a home office. And 10 minutes go by and he realizes that Sherry has not bounced into the house like she always does.
Yeah, it's been enough time to check the mail and drive the driveway and get in.
So he looks out the window. And he sees her little blue Chevette, the door's open, sitting right where it was 10 minutes ago when mom saw it.
Mm.
He doesn't see Sherry.
Okay.
He immediately thinks about the diabetes.
Oh, health problem. He's thinking,
so it's she's walking around.
No, he's hightailing it.
He jumps into the car, drives down to the end of the driveway, starts screaming her name, looks around, and he sees two things that are very ominous.
Okay.
He sees bare footprints headed towards the mailbox, but not back from the mailbox.
Oh.
And he looks into Sherry's purse, which is inside the car, and the door is still open.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees her medicine.
And no Sherry.
And there's no Sherry.
Oh.
So he's screaming.
Yeah.
Where are you? He's looking in the woods. Maybe she had to urinate suddenly, because that is one of the problems that you might run across with water diabetes.
Yeah, so he's just looking all over the place.
But he's this isn't right. Something's not right here.
Okay.
He drives back up to the house, calls the sheriff's department.
Yes.
Mom runs out of the house, jumps in the same car, drives back down again, and she's looking.
Yes.
Mm. No Sherry.
Mm.
Mom comes back. It takes about 30 minutes for the deputy to arrive.
Oh, gosh.
It took a little bit too long. But hey, you know, it's a small community. Much like this, if they're on the other end of the county, it's going to take them a minute to get there. There's probably two deputies patrolling.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take a minute.
Okay.
In the meantime, Dad hops back into the car, and he's driving up and down the road.
Yeah.
Platte Springs Road, looking for Sherry.
Yeah, because you want to start confined to that area. You're looking around the ditch. You're looking across the road. You're looking at, then you're going to like easily, you know, widen that search up and down the road until the police get there. I can completely picture what's happening.
Yes. And don't forget that I said that Bob Smith is a pastor. And one of the things that he does in addition to his other duties is he goes down to the local jail and he ministers to inmates.
Okay.
So everybody at the jail knows Bob Smith.
They know who.
And when Bob Smith calls you in a panic and says, my daughter's missing, they hit the panic button.
Mm-hmm. But so still took them 30 minutes to get there.
Well, once they realized what was going on, the full court press got put on pretty quickly.
Okay.
Lexington County Sheriff James Metz knows Bob. He knows the family. This is not a panicked call from somebody who doesn't know what's going on. We need to mobilize.
Okay.
Within not too long at all, we've all talked about SLED before, the State Law Enforcement Division of the state of South Carolina.
Yes.
We talked about that with the Murdochs back in May.
Yes.
So SLED gets involved that day.
Wow.
Airplanes, helicopters get involved that day. There is no chance that this is a runaway. Because, she's 2 days from graduating.
Well, and she's got big plans. She's got traveler's checks. But we also know that she has some major health issues and she does not have her medicine.
Yes.
And that's a big deal.
That's, the bell is ringing.
That's right.
So
panic. Yes,
this happens immediately. The next day's paper quotes Sheriff Metz as saying, we have no clues. She vanished.
Oh, that's terrifying.
From the end of her driveway.
From the end of her driveway.
And they looked out and saw her car. Mother saw it, said she's here.
Yeah.
10 minutes go
that,
by.
She was that close to being safe.
We are in a 10-minute window.
She was 750 feet.
From her home.
From still being alive today. Yeah.
Okay, Scott. So walk us through what happened.
Okay, so here's what nobody knew then, but we all know now.
Yes.
Here's what happened.
Okay.
Two people were driving up and down Platte Springs Road about the time that this happened. One in one direction, one in the other direction. They both saw a car. One of them saw the car hit the brake lights as he approached Sherry's driveway.
Okay.
As she was standing at the mailbox.
Okay. All right.
The other one was a woman who was driving before this happened. And she is going down the road and there's a car that is drifting over into her lane because the guy in the car is fiddling with something on the passenger side.
Okay.
Probably a .38 revolver.
So he almost hits her.
Yes. Okay. She lays on the horn. Yeah. He jerks the car back into his lane. Their eyes meet.
So she got a look at this guy. Okay.
She was the first person to provide a description to the police of what this guy might have looked like.
Good. All right. Let's
So we've got to start. Okay. So we know that somebody possibly saw Sherry at the bank parking lot.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And impulsively, this is the speculation, just snapped. I've got to have that.
Ugh.
I'm following her home.
Gross. I've got
a gun.
Yep.
I've got a .38 revolver. And so this person pulls over.
Okay.
Walks up to Sherry. Dad finds the mail laying on the ground when he gets to the mailbox. This person points the gun at Sherry, tells her to get in the car, come with him.
Okay.
And that's how she left the end of her driveway.
Yeah.
Never, ever to be seen by her loved ones again, it turns out. That happens at 3:25 on Friday afternoon. Full court press. We're looking. We're flying. We're trying to find her. The word goes out. Mm-hmm. The next morning at 2:20, the phone rings at the Smith residence.
Okay.
An electronically disguised voice says, you will get a letter in the mail today from Sherry.
Oh, gosh.
The voice specifically requests to talk to the mother, Hilda.
Okay.
Hilda says later that she didn't even realize, it's 2 in the morning, it's 2:20 in the morning. She didn't even realize until she hung up the phone, until the call had ended, that she wasn't talking to a police officer.
Oh, okay.
It occurred to her, she looked at her older daughter who has driven from Charlotte at this point, Dawn, and said, that man has Sherry.
Oh my God.
But it's only after she gets off the phone that she realizes that she's talking to the man who has kidnapped her 17-year-old daughter.
Oh my gosh.
So among the things that he says is there's going to be a letter. It's going to come in the mail tomorrow between 1 and 2. So he's either been stalking the Smiths for days and knows when their mail arrives, or he's gotten that information from Sherry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's about the time that the mail runs.
Yeah.
So Sheriff Metz gathers his deputies together. They run down to the post office. And they start going through the mail. They're not going to wait until the mail gets delivered at 2 o'clock.
Nope, yeah. We're getting it
They get
now.
To the post office at 4 a.m., and it takes him 3 hours to find the letter.
Okay.
And there is one.
What does it say?
It's in an envelope. There's no return address. There is a Mallard duck stamp, a 22-cent duck stamp, which was first-class postage at the time.
Okay.
And the letter was basically... According to John Douglas in his book about it, John Douglas is the FBI profiler that we've mentioned several times before, but he has written a book about this, okay. And it'll be in the notes if you want to read it. I think it's called When a Killer Calls is the title of the book.
Okay.
But he mentions in this book that it was basically her farewell to her family.
Oh my gosh.
At the top of this, it's two pages, 2 8.5 by 11 yellow legal pad pages with blue lines. That is later confirmed to be Sherry's handwriting.
Okay.
And at the top it says, last will and testament.
Oh my gosh.
And so one of the things that John Douglas does in his book, and he just spends a paragraph on it, but just think about this as we move along. Does she have a gun to her head? Is she being...
forced to write this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what I would be thinking. Yeah. Because a 17-year-old is not.
Google Sherry Smith, Last Will and Testament, if you want to read this. I'm not going to read very much of it, just a couple of lines, just to kind of give you a sense of what her thought process was. Mm-hmm. But if she knew it when she wrote that, mm-hmm. that she was about to die, mm-hmm. she was the most chipper. She made a joke to her dad. At one point, she writes, I love you all so damn much. Sorry, Dad. I had to curse once. There's a joke in her last will and testament. So I don't know if she... That makes me think that she didn't really think that she was going to die when she wrote that.
Maybe not. Just for her sake, maybe not.
I hope not. Because it just... She loves her family, and I miss you guys, and don't let this ruin your lives, and some good will come of this. And don't forget that I said... Some good will come of this. So the two-page letter ends up being a very valuable piece of evidence.
I'm sure.
To get to the bottom of what happened here.
Yeah, the cops are...
And we'll go into that next week.
The cops at this point are extremely interested in this letter.
Yeah.
And all that it tells, the story, not just the words.
Yeah.
But are there fingerprints? What is on this letter that we can get?
Well, and John Douglas says in his book, one of the things that usually ends up with people like this getting caught is they can't resist the temptation to interact.
No, they want to insert themselves.
And the more they insert themselves into
the investigation,
mm-hmm. the easier it gets to figure out who they are and what their motivation is and where they are and where they're calling from, maybe. Or just the more you get in, don't. If you're going to kidnap somebody, run.
No, if you're going to kidnap somebody, keep inserting yourself. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Keep doing it. Yeah, everybody thinks that, and I don't know, I've often thought about this when you talk about cases like this. Does everybody think that they're the Zodiac, that they're going to...
This guy did.
...get around the investigation? You know, Zodiac was a fluke. The fact that Zodiac was not caught, and honestly, if you go back and listen to Zodiac, there's some arguments that he was caught.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't know to pinpoint him as the Zodiac.
Yeah. Right.
But everybody thinks they're so brilliant, and they think they're above the law. And I hope that they
think they're smarter than... I mean, think about Edmund Kemper. When we talked about Kemper, they all think they're smarter than the cops.
I hope that they continue to think this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like this.
Well, that's how they get caught. And that's how this guy got caught.
It's how, and this is the only time you'll hear me mention this one. It's how BTK got caught.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he thought he was so stinking smart.
Yep.
Yep.
That's a common denominator in all of these. I would categorize this as a serial killer case.
Okay. Well, let's find out why. Keep going, Scott. Right.
So for 2 days, the phone does not ring.
So we've had one call and
that one call says, hey, okay, be on the lookout for the letter.
Okay.
And then on June the 3rd, so 3 days have passed, he says, hey, be on the lookout for the letter. And that's on a Saturday. So he figures the mail doesn't run on Sunday, so you're going to get the mail on Monday. Mm-hmm. But they've already got the mail
so
that
they get
day.
It early.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So he calls back when he thinks that the mail has had time to run.
Mm-hmm.
And he
mm-hmm.
says, hey, did you get the letter? Now you know. And he's talking to mom again. He's talking to Hilda Smith.
Mm-hmm.
You know that this is not a hoax.
Yep.
He describes what Sherry was wearing.
Okay.
Obviously not a hoax call.
Okay.
Mom says, are you taking care of my daughter? She has a disease mm-hmm. and she doesn't have her medicine. Click.
He hangs up.
Yes. And these calls are being traced. After the first call, there was no... Sled had already put traces on the phone lines before the first call happened, but they had not set up a recording device when that first 2:20 a.m. phone call came in on the 1st of June. But now they were recording these phone calls.
So they get this particular one.
At this point, they've got his voice. Mm-hmm. They're recording everything that he says. And one of the things that they figure out is that call was made from about 7 miles away at a payphone at a convenience store about okay. 7 miles away from where the Smiths live. And when I say 7 miles away, I'm going to always refer to the Smiths' home.
7 miles from the Smiths' home.
Yes.
Okay, from a payphone.
Yes.
And he clicks.
On Platt Springs Road.
Now, does he click? Do they think because he's assuming the tracers and he's only allowing so much time?
Yes.
Or
that's part of it.
Does it have to do with the specific question she asked?
Well, I guess that's open for debate and we'll never know, but it seemed like he never talked on the phone long enough mm-hmm. for them to figure out
exactly where he was.
While he was still on the phone, at
right.
least. And, you know, technology was a lot different in the 80s than it is today.
Well, and there was a certain time limit on a tracer.
It was 15 minutes.
You had to keep somebody... 15 minutes on a phone is a long time to try to keep someone talking. And
15 minutes on the phone with me is an eternity.
And it's my understanding that he has this MO that he will hang up right before the 15-minute mark. And then he will call back at times. Is that correct?
No, that's not what happened. This is never like a hang up and call back thing. At least not that I was able to discern.
Each call is less than 15 minutes.
Yes.
Purposefully.
He is, yeah.
And
the thing is, and I've noticed as I did my research, he gets a little bit further away from the Smith home every time. The first call is 7 miles away. The next one, 9 miles away. The next one, 15 miles away. He eventually ends up like 50 miles away.
Okay.
Before we finish with these horrible phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
So
let me just say this, Scott. It's also interesting. He's only wanting to talk at this point to the mom.
Exactly.
Because why doesn't he want to talk to the dad?
I think that he has a problem with male authority figures. I mean, there is even a case where later in the phone calls, either mom Hilda or sister Dawn asks about the boyfriend because Sherry has a boyfriend named Richard
mm-hmm.
who figured prominently into her last day. I mean, they were together and went to the pool party and that kind of thing. And the kidnapper knows about that guy and he tries to play that down at one point. Like, oh, no. She never liked him to begin with. He actually says on the phone, and I'm paraphrasing, but basically that. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't want to talk to the male figures because he can't control them, he thinks.
We're getting into John Douglas
FBI profiler stuff here, but yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to was he more of a, I mean, I'm basically calling him a wuss.
That's yeah.
Because he doesn't want, you know, he's afraid to talk to the men.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead.
I wonder what would have happened if they'd have put dad on at the phone.
He probably would have hung up.
He was
too much of a wimp to talk to him.
So that's on a Monday when that call comes at 3:08 a.m. and p.m. I'm sorry. And mom says after she asks about the medicine and how her health is, the caller says, you'll know in 2 to 3 days. And she's like, what are you talking about? What is 2 to 3 days? She doesn't get an answer on that. Later that afternoon, the family holds its first press conference at the end of the driveway. You can pull up and see it. They're all, you know, like you would be if your daughter's been abducted and your sister. just arm in arm and please bring her back and we don't care. Just drop her off somewhere and call us and we'll come get her, that kind of thing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To try and reach out, because the FBI has gotten involved at this point, and I'm not going to make this a John Douglas FBI case, but he does get involved. The behavioral sciences unit in Quantico does get involved in this case quite prominently. Mm-hmm. We're going to downplay that. It's fine, because there aren't a lot of cases where the behavioral sciences unit can interject themselves into a case. Mm-hmm. If it's a standard, if it's a bank robbery or a murder, that's pretty easy for the local guys to figure out. Mm-hmm. But if it's something obscure, something weird, something strange, something spread out over days with phone calls and
mail. He's involved in
the mail system. Mm-hmm. If we can figure out what this guy looks like or what he talks like or how old he is, maybe we can spread the word and somebody saw this guy at the payphone, mm-hmm. at the gas station.
Right, right.
And we can piece this together. So they get involved. So that's one reason for the press conference. The third phone call comes later that night. Still on the Monday, June the 3rd. The voice on the phone says to Mrs. Smith at one point, Sherry and I are now one. Ugh. Emotionally, physically, and spiritually.
Gross.
Yeah. And that's, if there's one takeaway from that phone call, that was it. The fourth phone call comes the next day at 9:45 at night on June the 4th. And the caller describes to, again, he's talking to the mother. Actually, this is the phone call where he asks for both of them to get on the phone. He wants Dawn and Hilda both on the phone.
Okay.
He wants to describe what happened. And he says, she was kidnapped with a gun. I made her get into the car. That was on Friday at 3:25 p.m. on Saturday at 3:10 a.m., she wrote the last will and testament, and he kind of flubs what he's saying, and he says 4:58 a.m., no, I'm sorry, 3:10 a.m., that's when she wrote the letter. At 4:58, we became one. We became one soul. It turns out...
I don't like the way this is going at all.
That's when he killed her.
Yeah.
She was alive for 12 hours after, we know now, mm-hmm. She was alive for 12 hours after she was kidnapped from the end of her driveway at gunpoint. But he's still telling mom. He's not really telling mom, but he's not telling mom that she's not alive.
Well, yeah. We became one makes me think of
pretty obvious
else too. Like, no, it doesn't make me think of.
Well, it makes murder. Me think of a sexual assault.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's
most likely.
And that's what he means.
That's exactly what he means.
That's what he means. Yeah. He just can't come out and say it.
Right.
Yeah.
And also in that phone call, before we get to that point, he says, I'm going to turn myself in tomorrow, have an ambulance ready between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. at your house, as if to imply that she's still alive and she's fine.
And she will need medical
care. And she's going to need medical care when she gets back because she hasn't had her medication.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth call was the next day.
And what day is this?
This is June the 5th.
Okay.
So the fourth call is on the 4th. The fifth call is on the 5th. I think that's a coincidence, but he's calling once a day for the most part.
Okay.
And the next day he says, he gives directions.
Okay.
To a location 15 miles away from the Smith home.
All right.
In the neighboring county, which is Saluda County. And here we go with multiple jurisdictions again. And we all know how complicated that gets.
Yes.
And we'll get into that next week.
Now, did they determine that the call was near this area that he gave directions, or is he further away from the directions?
He called from 16 miles away this time.
Okay, and he's
so he's getting further away.
But he's giving directions that's 15 miles away, so...
He's giving directions that are to this location.
Okay.
And sure enough, when the cops get there...
They find Sherry.
They find Sherry's dead body.
Oh.
And it's been 5 days.
Yeah.
And John Douglas says in his book, you know, obviously it seems to me that this guy was smart enough to know that I'll tell you in 2 or 3 days comment that he made into one of those earlier phone calls was if it's 100 degrees in South Carolina.
He's waiting on decomposition.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that
there'll be as little as possible DNA.
The exact cause of Sherry Smith's death is undetermined to this day. There was just... They think she was smothered, and that's what the story is.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no way to physically know.
Yeah.
Because of the decomposition to her body over the course of 6 days.
Yeah. And based on the phone calls and the, and, you know, looking into this case, one of the theories is that she was smothered or strangled or, but the sexual assault was either
most likely
during that time or after that time.
Yeah. That was on the 5th of June. The next day, the biggest newspaper in the state of South Carolina, which is called The State, the headline is "Sick Killer Sought in Murder."
I would say that's accurate.
Yes.
At 2:30 that afternoon, Charlie Keyes, who is a TV announcer, a newscaster at the Columbia TV affiliate, gets a phone call that turns out to be the same voice that Hilda has been hearing for the last 5 days. He says that he wants to turn himself in. He says, "I'm going to turn myself in at 7 o'clock in the morning at Sheriff Metz's house. You need to be there. You're the guy that I'm going to give the exclusive interview to. Be there at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning." So, and he says a lot of things in that. It's a long phone call.
Because he knew it wasn't being traced. So he was on the phone.
He had some time.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen.
Shocker.
The next morning, Charlie Keyes shows up at Sheriff Metz's house at 7 a.m. and they sit around for a couple of hours.
And they're like,
nothing happens.
Oh. So he's just sending people on wild goose chases now? Or?
Are we at all shocked that he's got two men sitting there? He will barely talk to men on the phone. Mm-hmm. He's going to just walk up to two men? No.
I really think that there is a mental issue about this person that we need to get into in the next episode.
And we will.
But I cannot wait to pick your brain about this guy next
week.
And
we will.
We'll really want to, because I'm confused about what I'm reading and hearing and seeing, because it's almost like a split personality situation to me. But you are not a doctor, so I want to talk to you about it.
Okay, good.
Anyway, so that same day on the 6th of June, there is another phone call to the Smiths. This occurs at about 8:57 p.m. And this time the caller wants to speak with the sister. He wants to speak with Dawn. He tells her about his phone call earlier in the day to the TV announcer, says he's going to turn himself in, and he tells Dawn how he killed his sister.
How he killed her sister.
He says, "I wrapped duct tape around her head and smothered her, all the way around her head and smothered her." He tells Dawn that.
Okay.
On the phone. The next day... I'm sorry, 2 days after that, on Saturday, June the 8th, the funeral takes place. So they've got her body. They've gone to the funeral home. Everything's done. And so they hold the funeral, and SLED and the local law enforcement are looking for anybody that looks suspicious at this funeral, because we've all done this enough now that we know a lot of times they like to show up.
And as much as this guy's wanting to interact,
they didn't see him, but he was there.
I'm not shocked.
He was there. The next call happens later that evening, or later that afternoon. This is the seventh call of eight. We're almost done. There's eight total phone calls to the Smiths.
Okay.
And this is call number seven. This happens not long after they've gotten back from their daughter's fucking funeral.
Well, because he knew when the funeral was and when they got home, I'm sure.
It's a collect call from Sherry. Let that sit for just a second. For just a fucking second.
Wait, how do
it's a collect call from Sherry. Will you accept the charges?
Okay, so
they know who it is.
This is how Katie when
that's the this is what I was gonna ask you.
So when you used to do a collect call,
she doesn't know what we're talking about.
You would just give the operator a name.
It's only collect calls I'm familiar with are from the inside of jails.
Yeah.
Well, it's same process.
It's similar. And the operator.
And you can tell that story next week.
You would pick up the phone. Yeah. You would pick up the phone and you would say, and you would hear, you have a collect call from, and sometimes it would be an operator or sometimes it would be a recording. And then when there would be a pause, you would hear the person say their name.
So the operator just said Sherry. Or what?
I don't know if it was an operator or if it was recorded.
The person himself said, it was like Sherry.
Yeah, you have a collect call from Sherry.
Yeah.
Do you accept the charges? And you say yes or no. or you press a button to accept.
Right.
And then you're connected with
the person. So first of all, that means that he's a good bit away because long distance was, I mean, anything out of your local exchange. I mean, there was a time if I wanted to call a friend of mine in San Rock, that was a long distance phone call.
Yeah.
Right. And then it was Birmingham, and then it was Tuscaloosa, and then it was the Southeast, and then cell phones came along, and long distance phone calls went away.
Yep.
But in 85, that was a thing.
Right.
It turns out he's 50 miles away when he makes his phone call.
So he, after the funeral, he hightails it 50 miles away.
He gets out of town so he can, you know, not to be seen or heard, and he makes his phone call. He describes him, and now he just wants to exclusively speak to Dawn. He has transferred his attention to the older sister.
And how old is she at this time?
I'm going to say she's 20 or 21. Sherry was 17, and she's 20 or 21. She's living in Charlotte in an apartment.
I think she might have been 19.
Okay, maybe so. Maybe so.
She sounds very young on these calls.
She was the older sister, but still a young person, very young.
When you hear her talking to him on these calls, she sounds very young.
Yeah.
Which I believe is why he focused his attention to her at this point.
I think that's spot on. He talks about when he gets on the phone with Dawn, he talks again about his plan to surrender, which John Douglas says that's bullshit. He was never going to do that. That was just an excuse to call.
It was a way to get people talking to him.
He makes sure that everyone knows that he is, and I'm air quoting here, highly intelligent.
Oh, okay.
And John Douglas says, you know what? Usually if you tell me that you're not yanking me around, that means you are.
Yeah.
If you tell me you're not playing games, it means you are. If you tell me you're highly intelligent, it means you're not.
Correct.
Yeah, highly intelligent people don't have to tell you.
No, so you just know.
He mentions that. He tells Dawn a lot about the conversations that he had with Sherry while she was his captive.
Because he is now trying to connect with Dawn. He's trying to look good for Dawn.
Yeah. He knows that she has an apartment in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. They were going to sing together this summer at Carowinds, which is an amusement park, kind of like Six Flags, close to Charlotte. Mm-hmm. Sherry's plan was to move into the apartment with Dawn, spend the summer there. She had some vocal issues that were going to preclude her from doing that, but she was still going to have that senior, you know, that summer after your senior year that we all had that was amazing, right?
Exactly.
She was so looking forward to that. So that's, he's trying to connect with Dawn at this point.
Yes.
But he tells her that she says, why didn't you surrender this morning? At this point, she knows about the phone call to the TV personality. He said, I just didn't have the balls to go through with it. He's a wuss, like you said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's also trying to make himself seem to Dawn as not as dangerous as he's kind of playing this game back and forth with her when you hear these.
He's going to step in that in just a minute.
Yeah.
So that was on June the 8th. On June the 14th, there haven't been any phone calls since June the 8th. That was the last one. On June the 14th, the local Crime Stoppers TV guys put together a reenactment of what happened at the end of Sherry's driveway. They're just trying to put it out there so that maybe somebody will call in and maybe somebody saw something, right? That was on June the 14th. On June the 14th, a 9-year-old girl named Deborah Mae Helmrich was playing in her front yard with her 3-year-old younger brother, Woody. Just minding her own business. 9 years old. Dad's inside. He just got home from work. He's making a sandwich. He's about to come back out and hang out with the kids.
Well, you should be able to leave your children in your front yard.
You should be able to.
Their own front yard to play.
Well, in Lexington County, South Carolina, in June of 1985, you could not, as it turns out. The next thing Mr. Helmrich knows, somebody is banging on his door. It's his neighbor. He said, hey, man, somebody just pulled into your yard and grabbed your 9-year-old daughter and threw her into the car and drove away with her.
Oh, my gosh. And so the neighbor has a description of the car.
And the guy.
And the guy.
Yes.
Okay.
That is 8 days after the last phone call, 30 miles away from where the Smiths live. 8 days later, after that.
Okay.
Deborah Mae Helmrich disappears on Friday, June the 14th, 2 weeks to the day after Sherry Smith disappeared.
Okay.
It is 8 days later before the Smith family's phone rings again.
And this is on June what?
This is on June the 22nd at 12:17 in the morning.
Ugh, okay.
Dawn is still at home. She has not gone back to Charlotte yet. The family is still
staying close
in crisis mode.
Yeah, yes. They're grieving.
They're grieving together. And the same voice says, Dawn, you can't be protected. It's just a matter of time. Maybe a week, maybe a year. God wants you to join Sherry Faye. And by the way, have you heard about the disappearance of Deborah Mae Holmrick? And we will tell you more about that in next week's conclusion to this episode about the disappearance of Sherry Smith and Deborah Mae Holmrick. I have so much trouble saying that. Anyway.
Oh, it's horrible.
That is terrible.
Yeah, I feel weird inside.
I know.
Yeah.
Yep. And we're going to learn all about the individual.
And you're going to hate him as much as we do.
You're going to hate him. But you know what? There is going to be an Alabama tie.
That is correct. There will be.
I'm teasing that.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah, there is.
All right. So, all right. What do we need to tell everybody before we get out here, before we run out of song? Unless Shane sticks his head out of the bathroom door and finishes it again.
Scares us to death again. Just everybody visit truecrimeoneasystreet.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and write a comment so that we can give you a shout out.
Shout out to Christy Pope. I bumped into her over the weekend. She told me that she has started listening to the podcast. I said, did you start at the beginning? She said, yes. I said, stick with it. It gets better.
We get better. That's what I tell everyone too. I can't.
Start at the beginning. We're still figuring it out.
You can start anywhere.
You really can start.
Yeah, that's
except
true.
Don't start on a part two or a part three. Oh my gosh, there's Shane again.
Oh my God. Are you still here? How long does it take you to go to the bathroom? All right. We'll get to that later. A lot of things that we probably forgot to mention, but we'll do that next week, right?
Sounds good.
Are you guys done?
Yeah.
Good night, everybody.